Hey, thanks for tuning in and listening to or watching another episode of the Reforge Roundtable. And I am joined this week with Ginger. And last week I was joined by 30. And now 30's out and Ginger's in. We're getting to kind of showcase each of them on their own. 30 and Still Gaming is taking a trip. And now Ginger is feeling better, not under the weather. Thanks for being here, my friend.
Oh, man. Thanks for having me, dude. Yeah, I messaged you guys. I was like, I am so sorry. I had a fun little stomach bug that was going around the house all week last week, and then it grabbed me Thursday night, and then I woke up Friday, and I was like, I'm going to lay down. I'm just going to stay here. So by the time Saturday was on, I was feeling much better. And so this week's been great. No one's been sick, and as a parent, like you just get what you get, and you kind of roll with it.
It's like waiting to be executed when the sickness is moving through the house. You're like, who's next? Because I guess it's going to get me next.
And what happens, and I'm sure you've probably experienced this, but like you know one is not feeling well, and then you turn and you realize that they've been drinking out of your water bottle or cup or something like that while your back was turned. You're like, oh no, you got me. You sneaky son of a gun, you got me.
It's exactly how it goes down. Guys, if you are here in the live audience, thanks so much for being here. Make sure and smash like, make sure and hit subscribe and the bell button. If you're watching the VOD or you're listening to this elsewhere, you can always catch us on YouTube on Friday afternoons around 3 p.m. Eastern. We go live on Reforge Radio all throughout the week with the Rundown, where we do a rundown of gaming news. And then on Friday, we do the Reforge Roundtable. And typically, it will be me, 30 and So Gaming, and Ginger. If you want to look them up, you can look up Ginger Prime on YouTube or 30 and Still Gaming on YouTube. And then obviously all the Reforged channels are there if you want to check them out. And we have a lot to talk about in this episode. We're going to kind of break this into four parts. We'll kind of hit the ball back and forth. I'm going to kick things off talking about what was going on this week with PlayStation Plus and some of the drama and the controversy around pricing and how Sony officially responded. And then Ginger's going to be talking to us about some stuff going on with Square Enix and third-party software, and they're being kind of strict about it. It'll go back to me then. We'll kind of talk about game delay dilemma and how that's where we're still kind of continuing to feel the effects of the sickie, as we call it, and the shadow of what happened there with keeping things from coming out on a reasonable time. And then we've got a New World sort of update from Ginger. What's going on in New World? I know they're doing lots of things over there. I kind of bailed on the game, as did many, and I think it'd be great to hear what's going on over there. We may have a bonus topic for you at the end if we have time for it, but I don't want to whet your appetite for it if it doesn't happen. So I'm just going to tell you that there might be a bonus topic at the end. So let's just kick things off with this PlayStation Plus thing, because I was getting so much disagreement on this, which was shocking, because I used to work for AT&T for 5 years, and then I worked for Charter Communications. So prorating bills, losing discounts is just sort of business as usual in those environments.
Right.
And
absolutely.
What essentially happened is, for those of you that don't know, the PlayStation Plus, it is the Extra and the Deluxe. Here in the States, it's going to be the Extra and the Premium. But the Extra and the Deluxe launched in the Asian market. I think the reason they're calling it Deluxe is if that market can't have access to the cloud stuff, they call it something different to differentiate.
Yeah.
And people started upgrading. They started upgrading, and it was charging them money that they didn't think that they should pay, because they got in and prepaid for like a year, and they got this huge discount. And they were going to have to pay the higher premium now. And they felt like they should have been charged that higher premium minus the discount that they were already enjoying. And in my experience, that just isn't how it works. When you switch to a new internet package or cell phone package, you sort of leave behind those discounts and those promos. So that's kind of how it started. Before we get into what Sony did as a response, what was your thoughts on that? Because I was sort of like, this is business as usual.
Well, I would say, and I would agree on the business as usual, if there was not another example in the room. And Microsoft with Game Pass, with the upgrading pass that they've done, literally getting years of Game Pass for a dollar just to upgrade your account from Gold to Game Pass. Like, when it comes down to it, it's that if that is essentially what we're striving for, and the comparisons, no matter what, will be drawn between PlayStation Plus and Plus Premium and Plus, you know, your dog and your cat, and you know, like at the end of the day, like they've got all these different tiers that it does become a little bit confusing. In fact, I think Microsoft could do a little bit better job of even simplifying their offerings with the fact you have Gold but that's a whole another topic for another day. So when you look at what Microsoft did, is the path of upgrading was, the value is like literally there. Like, why would you not? And so, like, I totally understand where you're coming from in terms of AT&T and Charter Communications. I've been there, you know, like when having to deal with those and upgrades and what bonuses and oh, I'm already been a 5-time year, you know, a player, but in order to take care of that bonus, I have to cancel my account and re-sign up just so I can get like this rate. Like, why can't you just give me the rate? Because reasons, right? So I've been in those situations, and no matter what, those are always frustrating. So I don't, I get that people are frustrated with that because it just makes it just a little bit more resistant. It feels a little bit more like, okay, yeah, okay, I get that it's the price, et cetera. And then you go and look at what Microsoft is like, oh yeah, for a buck, you're good. You know, oh, you have 3 years of gold. For a dollar, you got 3 years of ultimate, you know? Oh, this is great. Ultimately, here in 3 years, you know, are they going to be just as mad that they have to start paying $15 a month as opposed to their, you know, their dollar upgrade? But maybe, but it's just an easier pathway. So I think in a bubble, it makes sense. But when you actually start to compare it to what else the market's offering, it just seems like, come on, Sony, just go and be cool. Just be cool. That's my thoughts. Those are my thoughts.
Yeah, and I think they ultimately determined that, because my whole point when people would bring up the Game Pass, and I was like, well, yeah, they are doing everything they can to fill the funnel. I remember we would have people come back in to get a new cell phone, and they'd be like, well, the last time I did this, the car charger was free, the case was free, the phone was free. And I was like, well, yeah, that was when they wanted to get everybody to get a cell phone. That's all that matters. Just get them on a plan. Give them the whole store for free if you have to, right?
Yeah, whatever they want.
And then once people were hooked, all of a sudden it was like, yeah, we're not doing that anymore. We're not giving you all this great free stuff. And I said, Microsoft is in that phase right now. They're in that building phase of fill the funnel, make it a dollar. You know, I said, it's like they're turning everything, they're turning their ecosystem into Dollar General. It's like everything is a dollar. It's like, you know, just get them in the funnel, make everything free and awesome. And I think Sony concluded that that was the best approach here, because I said, listen, my frustration with it was primarily the gaming press was using phrases like, you have to pay the discount back, or they're going to bump up what you have to pay and remove your discount. And it's like, you're switching plans. Like, that's not how this has ever been phrased before in the history, like, of ever. It's like, they're not making you pay anything back. So my irritation was primarily with how it was sort of being represented by gaming press and by people talking about
it. Shocker. Gaming press misrepresenting stuff. Oh. Anyway.
Exactly. And I've had my own, you know, brush with, you know, the gaming press handling things in a pretty, you know, there's a lot of journalistic malpractice. I guess journalism is probably being used pretty loose to refer to a lot of these essentially blog sites. So I was frustrated, and I think Sony concluded similar things to the essential strategy of Microsoft right now, which is just get people on the plans, okay? So they, within like a 24-hour period, started giving people their discounts and crediting back. Now, they claimed it was a bug, which is kind of funny, because they had already responded to a couple of people in emails saying, no, this is how it's supposed to work, right? Mm-hmm. You're going to get prorated, and you're just going to have to pay the difference. And I kept referring to an internet package. I was like, you know, if an internet company came around to your neighborhood and said, hey, we have a faster speed available now, you'd leave your discount behind, you know, when you upgrade, because, you know, that's how they get you. They, you know, they get you to sign up with those great discounts, and you don't get to keep them if you suddenly switch things around. And so Sony probably just said, listen, this isn't worth it. The PR was getting away from them. It hasn't even hit in the West yet, and they were getting really taken to task in the Asian market. So I think they ultimately made the right call to be like, this is not worth it. Whatever money we're going to lose, we'll gain it back in like a month when everybody's converted over.
Well, exactly. And when you think about that PR, like when you've seen good PR like go well, and we've seen Microsoft step on their own, you know, on their own momentum with similar things with their models and the business practices, to where it's like, why did you do that? Why did all of a sudden, remember when gold last year, all of a sudden it was like, okay, we're going to raise the price of it and it's going to be required. And it's like, oh, no, okay, never mind. We're rolling that back, and we're making free-to-play games not require gold. Everybody's like, yay. Imagine if we could just cut out that whole you know, frustrated part and you literally just made that second announcement, everybody would be thrilled, you know, because especially the expectation was like, maybe they might drop Gold because Game Pass is such that, you know, kind of their key platform, but clearly they didn't. And, you know, a year has gone by and there doesn't seem to be any signs of that. So in Sony's case, it is one of the, it does, like, based off the emails, like you said, does sound like they were like, okay, wait, let's, it's going to be easier, cheaper. Let's just make it easier and cheaper. And by the time it hits the West, then everybody wins. And that's actually should be applauded. We should look at when a company gets that kind of feedback and instead of doubling or tripling down, digging their heels in, they go, oh, okay, you know what? This actually makes a little bit better sense. We will make it up on the back end. We saw that actually with the price of the PS5, where they wouldn't wait. They were waiting and waiting and waiting. And then they're like, okay, now we're going to match Microsoft. But yeah, our game price is going to be a little bit up, so we can make it up on the back end, so we can kind of help spread that cost out over time. And yeah, it's a smart play. I think it's a good thing. And I always want to applaud, you know, a game company that gets feedback. I'm sure you see these kind of comments like, well, they should have done it right the first time, the right way. Well, yeah, you know, but that's, what are you going to do, man? Like, you're going to sit here and be angry at them both ways when they do the thing that you want. Why would they even listen to your feedback in the future if all it is going to be just negative, angry, you know, nonsense?
Yeah, I had people saying that, you know, if they're going to bend this quick on this, then if enough people complain about big first party Sony titles not going on PS Plus, you know, on their launch date, they'll switch that too. And I said, oh no, this is very different. So this is a one-time thing. They're going to lose a little bit of money on this that they'll gain back every month that all these people are on this service, but I can't see them giving over to anybody complaining about, oh, well, God of War Ragnarok should be on PlayStation Plus on the launch date. That's been something I've been engaging with, is the Microsoft guys are of that opinion. They're like, well, you know, Starfield and Redfall are going to be on Game Pass day one. Sony's not doing that. They argue that's like a huge value loss. I actually am in full support of Sony not doing that, because I love the fact that they're saying no. I mean, these games selling at full price is extremely important to this ecosystem. It's important to this cycle of reinvestment that we're doing. And I think that's so contrary to the dialogue around games and game prices lately.
Yeah, counterpoint though, just for thought and discussion, because while I actually agree with you, I'm happy that they're doing it, namely because I think market choice is a good thing, and we can kind of see who ends up taking the cake. Same kind of concept with Netflix versus Disney Plus. Does it make more sense to roll out your show all at once, or does it make sense to roll out your show week over week? I've heard arguments for and against both, you know, models, right? So having, you know, a similar service but with different kind of options will be interesting to see how gamers respond to it. So from a market research study, totally with you. But counterpoint is that how many people are just going to sit here and say, oh, I'll just wait? And I find myself doing that with Game Pass all the time. I was like, oh, that's clearly going to be a Game Pass game in a year. Do I need it today? And the answer most likely in my stage of life is no. But my answer is I'm still playing that game that I waited already on, and it's now in Game Pass, and that's where I'm going to put my time and attention. And so that's essentially kind of the counterpoint I see to where if it is inevitably going to be in Game Pass, all you're doing is charging the people who don't have the patience to sit down and wait. It's your money. Everybody's got their choice of to spend their money the way they want. I make no judgments how you spend your money, but that's just essentially kind of how I see it. So I think it's a good thing market research wise, because that could be the best thing. It could come back that literally makes the most sense. But if you end up having a holy crap patient group of Sony PlayStation, you know, gamers, then really, what are you doing? You're kind of just shooting your own momentum at launch.
Yeah, yeah. I would say they're not going to feel it. The number of people that can hold out and wait is probably extremely small in comparison. Yeah. Commercially, their games have done so well. Like, if you looked at any of the reports for Spider-Man and Miles Morales, those two titles have just been insane. Now, some of that's the global appeal of Spider-Man. I mean, that's obviously helping. Yeah. He is the most popular superhero, but and you had it well timed with some movies. I think that also helped. However, yeah, the every time they resaturate the market with PS5s, they have a crazy surge of sales for all their first party titles. So I don't know if the number of people that are going to fence it and say, oh, I can wait 18 months or whatever, and it's going to, you know, it's going to land on the PlayStation Plus. I wouldn't be surprised if they don't even make it formulaic, like if they make it hard to predict when it's going to happen.
Oh, yeah. See, that's essentially where you end up getting to point where like, OK, wait, why is this game? Oh, this game's a year or 2 years later, et cetera. Either way, it's a good value proposition. Essentially, that's especially for me. Like if I did get a PlayStation, I'm still hunting for my five. If that ever does show up, like, yes, getting into that subscription model and being able to start playing some of these games that I haven't been able to play to this point ends up giving me a rich library right away. And I don't feel like I have to invest an additional hundreds and hundreds of dollars to start to participate in that. And I do think, like, and I see chat talking about, you know, like both companies are raking it in. Oh, absolutely. Gaming is a very profitable thing. And I think it should be and remain profitable, because that encourages investment and actually encourages more games for us to enjoy.
Well, and the market research points to the fact that the actual per year, what's the phrase they use? The per year adoption rate of new titles is sort of not as high as you would think it would be.
Right. It's hard. Yeah.
It's two or three games a year for most people. So the average gamer is not just buying every single title that comes out.
Right.
So that's where I think Sony's situation is so good, because if you attach, thank you, I couldn't think of the word, the attach rate. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the attach rate of titles, of new titles, is, you know, two or three games a year. So there's titles right now on PlayStation I know people passed on because they were a little different than maybe what they were accustomed to. The Demon's Souls remake would be a good example if you're not a FromSoft guy. Returnal would be a good example if you don't like Rogues. You might look at the Spider-Man games and think, I don't know, I'm not really a superhero guy. Death Stranding's a great example. That game turned a lot of people off because they heard it was like a walking simulator. Well, that's the beauty of this, is you can buy the games you really want to play at full price, enjoy them, and then later on down the line when they get kicked on PlayStation Plus, you can test them out for such a small amount. And in addition to that, would you take advantage of this? Because this has been one of the controversial points about the premium, the PlayStation Plus premium, is the between 2 and 5 hours. So they've actually come out and said games the size of Horizon Forbidden West, you would get a 5-hour demo of the game if you're on the highest PlayStation Plus premium. And I'm curious. People are saying, oh, they're charging money for demos. They're charging money for demos. I'm like, but no other platform is saying all games above $35 will let you play them for a certain amount of hours. Like, that costs money to build that infrastructure. Sony's building that. They're not making the developers do it. Sony's doing it. It's going to be like a timer. I'm sorry, not a demo, trial. It's a trial, not a demo. So you're not downloading a different download. It's the game. Yeah, it's the game, and you can play for a certain amount of time.
That's very Japanese. We've seen that, and we've seen Nintendo do that time and time again, where it's like, you get to play this game, and at some point, the game's going to be like, go ahead and buy it, you know. And at the end of the day, like, does that drive value to me? No. Generally speaking, because I'm hyper engaged in gaming, and generally I know what I'm going to spend my money on. And so I wouldn't be spending money just to have that as a feature. It would also have to be like, I don't know fully what's paired with it, because really until I get my PlayStation, I was like, oh, they've announced three tiers. That's interesting. If any of it has to deal where I can play it on PC, then I'm absolutely in. Because then I could actually play these games. So that's just where I'm kind of stuck right now, because my PlayStation, like, literally, this is the story of me and Sony. My PlayStation 4 died, and I was like, oh, we're just 18 months from what I would assume would be the PS5. I'll just wait and get that. And now I'm already just like, I'm not going to get a PS4. I'm going to find a PS5. And so I'm just kind of in this weird Sony limbo. And so a part of me is like, I'm happy to see them bring in a PC. So if they had a tier that was like, and it also runs on PC, like, that would be the value proposition. A cloud streaming piece, I know they have that with, that got bundled into the whole PlayStation Plus structure. That's something that would appeal to me, but it would have to appeal with the modern games. I don't care to go back and play PlayStation 1 or 2 games. There might be a value proposition for my kids doing that, but right now they're already happy with Game Pass. I already have that. So I'd have to be looking for something that, you know, is a little bit different.
Yeah, it's it's never been a big draw for me either to go back and play old games. Even when I have like a nostalgic attachment to them, is I play for 10 minutes. I'm like, okay, this is a great trip down memory lane, but I'm not playing this thing to completion. And yeah. So I didn't have a PlayStation until very recently. So I am not, you know, pulled in by all those old titles. And the other element of this with the waiting and with the other platforms is Sony is starting to say, hey, by 2025, like, half of our first party titles are going to be on PC. So yeah. Returnal's already been spotted in the Steam database. I mean, these games are going to be coming to PC very regularly, which
Sony is going to make so much money. And that's going to be really good for even the PlayStation brand. Even if they delay, like you said, it's unpredictable when something happens. But even if they bring Spider-Man to PC, like, great. You just literally funded probably another three Spider-Man games completely by doing just that aspect. And, you know, oh, cool. Maybe someone then goes and buys into your ecosystem. But overall, like, just put the games where people are. You know, a lockdown system doesn't necessarily apply in more of a modern world. I get it in the 90s. I can get it in the 2000s. I get it last decade. But we're in the 2020s. I'm like, and right now it's like, okay, like, I'll wait, you know, or I just won't play your game now because my game is on PC, or my game is, you know, like, this is where I'm gaming. And if meet me where I'm at, I don't stop asking me to make an extra purchase.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm excited for Returnal, especially because I didn't think it got the greatest treatment in the American press circuit and the Game Awards. Like, as soon as it was in Game Awards outside of America, it did much better. I think there were some Microsoft titles that kind of crowded the nominations that shouldn't have maybe been there. But, you know, we're in the West. You got to keep Microsoft happy. And I think Returnal being a rogue hurt it a little bit because it landed in a gaming drought. And a lot of people were just hungry to get a PS5 game. And it really turned a lot of folks off. But rogues do very well in the PC market. I think people are going to eat this thing up. It might be more commercially successful on PC than it was on the PlayStation. I honestly think that. So at this point, I think Sony's in a really, really good spot to fund their first party titles, to give a lot of value. I'm excited to see how people respond to it, how well it goes. And honestly, to get God of War Ragnarok this year, like, is a huge, huge plus. We'll get to the game delays and how that's been disappointing. It's like every time I turn around, another game is getting delayed. That's my sort of second topic for today, but I don't want to jump ahead. Our next topic was one that Ginger wanted to talk about last week, and I want to hear about this because I've played games that let you do third party stuff, and then apparently that's not cool with Square.
So to catch everybody up to speed, it's like the Final Fantasy XIV community specifically had basically kind of ran into a wall, and there was a very quick and sharp divide between two camps. Those who say, yes, add-ons are fine as long as I'm not cheating, and those who are saying, no, it's against complete terms of service. Now, Square Enix has not changed a policy at all. So what ended up happening is you have 20 years of a policy going from Final Fantasy XI and XIV being primarily their PC-driven games, where they've been both console and PC, but those are primarily also heavily played on computer, even though they are supported on console, or at least they were, 11 was, but now is no longer. But because of that PC console game, they've had this policy of no add-ons. The thing was, is that they actually started to enforce that policy, and that's essentially where all of a sudden everybody kind of ended up realizing they had to pick a side. And so you had people who were like, I'm just using add-ons to reshade the game. Just to make it visual, or maybe I even have a visual color correction that I need done and the game doesn't offer it. That is terms of service. And then you end up having basically witch hunters going around reporting anybody who was posting or streaming or making content around any kind of add-on, whether it was game breaking or what have you. And so it really challenged that. And so the game director, producer Yoshi P, who's also the producer of 16, which we probably might be seeing some 16 news at the State of Play next week, because it's actually Final Fantasy, Final Fantasy as a franchise's 35th anniversary. So there should be some really interesting stuff maybe dropping soon. So we'll be sure to cover it here if that is the case. But that all being said, is that all of a sudden the community had to realize, like, oh, this is against terms of service. My issue with it, like, the only issue I take with it is not that people were breaking terms and not that you know, add-ons are this be-all end-all good thing or a bad thing, because 14, especially as an MMO, has really grown over the last, you know, 13 years. And because of that, it's attracted a lot of people who are used to add-ons. The problem ends up being is basically the policy, while written, was saying absolutely not, you're going to get in trouble. The director and producer, Yoshi P, always said, just don't talk about it. Just don't talk about it. We can't see what's running on your computer, so just don't talk about it. And then years of that just became, oh, we're not going to get in trouble. And so everybody just kind of ended up building out these add-ons and had this, like, would talk about them and promote them. And we had people like hacking and beating, you know, the hardest content. And then all of a sudden that line, somebody pushed on that line so much that Square Enix said, no, we can't. And people started getting banned. You know, when I say bans, it's a temporary ban. I haven't seen any permabans going out, but yeah, it was just like, and so from a community perspective, it was like, oh, we done pissed off dad. And he's coming home and he's like, okay, I said, just don't talk about it. And you guys are screaming it from the rooftops, you know, kind of thumbing your nose up saying, you're not going to do anything. And then Square Enix was like, yes, we are. And so that's essentially kind of the TLDR of what happened with add-ons. And so essentially sparked a big debate within the 14 community of, should add-ons be allowed, yes or no? And that also morphed into, what from the add-ons do we want to have added into games, which we saw lots of resistance saying the game is perfect. We don't want anything from these add-ons. How dare you? But this is an online game. You're going to attract all kinds of people from all kinds of perspectives. So any questions or thoughts? Like, because that's just, you know, that's the story. I find it so fascinating in terms of kind of online, you know, should add-ons be allowed? And if so, like, what's the limitation, especially in an age where you can play on console and on PC?
Yeah, I mean, have they given a specific reason as to why they don't want it? Is it because they're worried about cheating or advantages or, you know, disparity between the platforms?
It's all of that, but it's primarily a disparity between the platforms. The fact that, like, if you're on PlayStation 4 or 5, you do not have access to these features. My view is that the failure actually is that those things apparently existed for so long and people have used them. Why hasn't Square Enix gone in and started implementing those features? Because that was Yoshi P's message. We're going to start implementing these features from the add-ons into the game itself. And it's like, that should have started years ago. But, you know, that's just my take as a veteran of Final Fantasy XIV.
I've always felt like one of the things that developers and even Nintendo and some of these companies, they're missing is such an easy way to work with the community. Like, mm-hmm. people are an asset. Your community is an asset to you. So why would you not just go through a process of, like, approving of, like, official approved APIs or something of that nature to, like, say, hey, yeah, here's the list of ones we've partnered with. We think they're trustworthy. We vetted them. Da 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 da. Then that might get into some legal issues of, like, well, what if the program causes an issue on somebody's computer or whatever? They could, you know, all they got to do is put a little disclaimer saying, you know, they're not responsible for the software if it causes you any problems or failure or whatever. I mean, there's pretty easy ways to protect themselves legally from that stuff. But I thought the same thing about emulation. It's like all these companies are like anti-emulation. It's like, why won't you just monetize it? Create an emulator marketplace, work with really well-known and good emulators who emulate these games, and then sell them. Sell these little emulated old games for $5, and then you know, Nintendo or whoever could take 10%, and then the emulator could get the rest, and then just start generating money off of it. And in this case with the API, I don't know if there'd be a way to monetize it or make money off of it, but I always feel like there's a better way forward than to be all, you know, like, micromanagey about it, especially if these things are helping your community enjoy your game more.
What's really interesting, you kind of bring that up, and that's one of the things that I think Square Enix is in this weird cultural position in which that, like Yoshi P said, that he would add an API, but Square Enix themselves keep saying no. And he's like, you got to give me the use cases so I can make the case to allow it, because they're afraid. They're afraid of opening up things, what it could mean, you know, what risks and exposures opening up APIs to their games could offer. And then at the same time, in the same breath, Square Enix is also like really pushing on these NFTs, really pushing on the kind of this crypto perspective that gamers are massively hesitant against. Mm-hmm. And that's where it's like, I just kind of always feel Square Enix has been this weird tale of two cities company where it's like some of the stuff is like, way to go. That was, you knocked that one out of the park. And then in the same week, like, oh man, and Square Enix really stepped on a landmine with that one. And I mean, and so and maybe that's just the cost of being such a global presence within gaming. But I, you know, I see some people in chat saying like, and the debate ends up always just kind of defining like, okay, what it should be allowed and what shouldn't be allowed in terms of that. And I think you know, when you look at the counterpart to 14, which would be World of Warcraft specifically, is that I think the devs have relied too much on the add-on community, and rather incorporating those features in game, they just design around that people will make, you know, make it add-ons to address the issue, address the shortcoming. And so I think essentially where I hope that the good positive of the story is that Square Enix is working with these add-on creators and then incorporating that in the game so PlayStation players can participate. I don't use add-ons. And so when I was all of a sudden being seeing all these people with all these different add-ons and what their game actually looked like, I was like, holy crap, that's gorgeous. Like, wow, can we get, yeah, I'll take that. I'll take all of that, please. And I'm not going to go break terms because I like my account. Thank you. But I'm like, yes, let's hopefully from a good perspective is that here in the next year or two, 14 gets better because of it. And yes, it has to be an open dialogue between the players and the devs.
Yeah, I remember playing, it might have been Call of Duty 2. They had these servers that had been modded and changed, and they had their own rule sets, and we had different, our little white dot crosshair was different. It was like red. Like, they did all these cool things, and I don't know. I understand the hesitancy because it is really easy. You know, people in chat are saying, you know, you inject code into the game, and these add-ons can allow people to cheat. And so I do get why they would say we just can't let anything in, because cheating is becoming just a massive, massive, ever-growing problem, because there's economic reasons to build cheats. There's, you know, money to be made, and for mm-hmm. whatever reason, there is a culture of people that would rather cheat. So I think that's, you know, those two things are kind of at loggerheads, where you're, you know, you have these people that are trying to make really cool tools and APIs and add-ons that you can use so you can move your inventory around or whatever the case may be, and then you have people that are probably going to be doing things that are maybe a little bit more malicious. So it makes sense for a company to try to protect its property and say, hey, we just can't allow this. The bummer would be is if you've got some really, really established add-ons, can't you just can't you green light those? Can't you make those ones okay?
I mean, and that's where, like, at least they're moving forward, but it, you know, Square Enix seems to be maintaining its like no add-on, you know, no exception policy. And that did catch a lot of players off guard, because they're not going through, like, when you agree to any kind of terms, you're just like accept, et cetera, you know, whatever. And then all of a sudden you're like hanging out with all your friends are like, oh yeah, use that add-on. And then all of a sudden you're getting messages, delete all the add-ons, get rid of it all right now. Don't show your screen to anybody. You will be banned. It's like, it was just like all of a sudden like, okay, this is, okay, that was always the world we lived in. And now it's essentially like, oh, the enforcement policy, you know, got funded. You know, like when you ever think about we made a law that says you can't eat hamburgers, but we didn't fund anybody to go and actually make sure that you weren't eating hamburgers. And all of a sudden the hamburger police got funded and you're like, oh my God, I thought that was a joke law.
Yeah.
Good times.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I like when the communities rally around and do things like that for games. I remember enjoying tools like that in another game, you know, that I used to play a lot, and they become almost a part of the experience, you know. So hopefully they can maybe come to some kind of an agreement, because it'd be really hard to let go, I would think.
Yeah.
So the did you have something else to add?
No, that's it, man. That's the story.
Okay. Well, the other thing we wanted to talk about is obviously these delays, right? Like we've gotten ratings for God of War Ragnarok, and we've got a rating for Forspoken. So they seem to be on track. And I was saying, like, I don't know. I had my gut, like, I developed almost like a gut instinct in the gaming world. Like, I don't think this is happening, because I remember saying, my gut tells me something's going to happen with Starfield. It's going to get delayed. And people thought I was just being a hater. It was more of a gut instinct.
They haven't shown anything. Like, we haven't seen anything of Starfield. And them delaying it, I was like, yeah, makes sense. And I've seen people, like, legitimately shocked. And I go, we haven't seen anything. We've seen a trailer. Like, when somebody shows me a trailer, like, I get that. I mean, but how many times as gamers do we go through this cycle of, like, oh, yeah, they showed me this barely anything of the game, it's gonna be great. Like, you can go and list thousands of games that challenge that narrative each and every time. And so, yeah, I'm with you. I was like, oh, that's obviously getting delayed. Hey, it got delayed. Yep, that makes sense. You know, like, I was like, why did they put a date on it in the first place? Like, oh, anyway, it's Bethesda, right? It's hype. They're just trying to generate hype and stuff. But go ahead, please.
That was the pushback on that one. I think it was a fair pushback. They said Bethesda has done this before. They wait and they wait and they wait, and then all of a sudden they show you everything. They want to wait as close to launch as possible, which, even with this delay, I think they're still going to do that. I still think they're going to get really close in proximity to Starfield before they show us anything. I just had, like, this feeling about the game, even though it was like Todd Howard said, this thing, the date is set in ink. I had a gut feeling. I had the same gut feeling about Forspoken. I thought, yeah, they're trying to do too much. It feels too big. It feels too ambitious. I don't think this thing's coming out. And I'm trying to point that out to people, that, like, one's a Sony game, one's an Xbox game. I had the same feeling about both games, but apparently Forspoken is on the way. There was rumors that Forspoken might get bummed.
It did already get bummed once, because they already announced a single delay for that. But the question then would be, would we see a second delay? And honestly, if Final Fantasy 16 is as close as it seems like it might be, it would be really cool to have that, you know, drop. And also then you have Forspoken. But I wouldn't see them, Square Enix, want to double up a month with both of those games, because you would, I think, clearly cannibalize Forspoken for 16. But imagine, you know, whether it's first or second, you know, it doesn't really matter. Imagine Square Enix being dropping two big titles this year, mainly and assumedly on the PS5 from an exclusivity perspective, maybe also on PC for 16. We're not really sure. They announced it for coming to PC, but then they quickly were like, let's just erase that off the trailer. So Square Enix could be setting itself up with it for a big year, big fall with two big hitter games. Honestly, Sony could be looking really strong, especially with these delays of Starfield and Redfall, which the only one that really disappointed me was Redfall, having still not really seen much outside of the trailer. Like, it sounds like an interesting game. I would definitely be willing to give it a shot, especially because of Game Pass.
Yeah, the rumor was that they were going to delay Forspoken because 16 was ready. They were like, basically like, yep, 16's ready. It's going to take the crown. And when I looked at the dates, I thought, well, maybe Forspoken's getting bumped to the holiday, like December, and maybe Final Fantasy's going to take that October release date. Right, and just separate them by a couple of months, because October, November could be really, really great. The first 2 months are typically when you make most of the sales, and then December could hit and Forspoken could kind of have its surge. Maybe it could flip, because right now Forspoken's date is October, I believe, 11th.
Something like that, yeah.
So you could see Final Fantasy land earlier than anticipated in the holiday window in December. There was another one called, I think it was called Escape. It was like a little side-scroller. It got bumped into next year. There was one for PlayStation called Tachiya, I think, or something to that effect. That one has been delayed. And it feels as though the way I described it the other day to somebody is, it's almost like the final, like, shadowy fingers of the sickie and working from home. It's like we're finally getting out from underneath that shadow. And, okay, things are going to start to hit a better rhythm. We're going to start to have things happening more often, because June's right around the corner with Summer Game Fest and all these announcements. I really do think the consistent theme is going to be surprise holiday releases of maybe smaller, lesser known titles. And then the big stuff, man, is all getting shoved to next year. 2023 is going to be jam packed with games. Sort of the way
February this year was hard. Like, it was so filled. I still haven't caught up on everything that was released in February.
Yeah, I think next year is going to be like that. It seems as though this year we're going to have Ragnarok, and Forspoken. There's a little indie title, if it comes out, called Scorn, like a scary indie title for Xbox coming. There could be some surprise releases. You know, we've thought maybe Elden Ring will get its DLC in the holiday, you know, season to kind of keep it back on everybody's radar, kick it back up the, you know, the top of mind marketing circuit, because Ragnarok's going to sort of take the crown for the last part of the year. Like, that's all everybody will be talking about. I'm just wondering if we'll ever get out of this rhythm. Like, are we just, is the car always going to have this flat tire on all these titles? Like, how long are we going to have to get away from 2020 before we feel as though game delays used to be so surprising? They would launch and be bad. That wasn't that rare.
Yeah.
But delays were sort of like, oh my gosh, that game must be in trouble. And now it's sort of every other day I'm reading a tweet that a game has been delayed. They have their little image they upload, and it's like, we regret to say this, we really want this to be our best game ever. It's way more common now. There could be good and bad that comes from that, though, because game companies could be more empowered to say, if it's not ready, you know, kick it down the road. What do you think this will be an ongoing effect, or do you think maybe next year we'll not be dealing with this as much?
Well, I mean, it obviously varies depending on the game type. Multiplayer games getting delayed, not shocker, because of the level of complexity that's entailed. One of the things that I wish I could infuse into all gamers' brains is that a single player game is immensely easier to build than a multiplayer game. There's so many more things that you have to do. And that means there's so many more entry points of things that can break, right? So you could literally be like, everything's great, but we've run into this bug that makes it unplayable, and nobody wants to run into that. It makes sense to delay. But do I think that we're out of the woods? Not for a while. But I think essentially the good thing that's going to come out of this is game companies are going to have a better model for understanding remote work and managing remote work. And that could actually make gaming and empower game development across all of these countries and nations. In fact, we've seen Bungie specifically saying, we will support a work from anywhere culture. And so you can go and kind of like, you don't have to go and live in their studio, because they've set up via the power of Stadia remote work. And I think, and hope that more studios follow suit, but that does change models. That does change management. Having worked and managed remote resources in other countries, like, I can tell you, like, yes, you have to really write out all your thoughts, and then you put them out there, and then you wait 24 hours, and then they get the response back, as opposed to like just going down to the office, knocking on a door and having that conversation in real time. So, like, that being said, is that I think essentially what we've also witnessed is that the management and the understanding when it comes to managing teams of this size and this complexity, stepping into we have to also figure out how to do that remotely now with these powerful machines while protecting our secrets, because nobody wants that to leak. Now they'll have a better business model, so you won't see them announce things until they have a better full understanding of it. And I think my hope is, in the industry, it's all really about the announcement. When the announcement happens, that's when gamers kind of have this clock ticking in their minds, because a game can't be delayed if it's not announced, right? You could delay it, you know, like, okay, guys, we need more time to really flesh this out. Like, I would love to see, and that's actually what I expect with 16, kind of bring this stop, you know, kind of 360 right back to where we started in a way, is that Yoshi-P said that when he shows us 16, he wants you to be able to purchase 16. He doesn't want to sit here and say, here is 16, and then 3 years later, you can purchase it. That's been the Square Enix model. Like, hey, we're going to announce this game, and then 10 years later, you might be able to buy it. 10 years of development hell, it's going to have its problems. Like, no, don't even tell me about your game until you're ready to at least accept my pre-order. Like, at least within no more than a year from when you tell me, like, hey, here's the game, you can pre-order it, it's going to be out, and then release it. That's my dream for the future. I would actually prefer everything do the Apex model of, and we have a game, and here it is, and boom, 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 boom. Like, we're firing on all cylinders. You can play it now. Not in 6 months. Not when, you know, no. Now. Why didn't you tell us about it? Because you would have, like, the YouTubers would have, like, taken this and made 1,000 scary videos of how is it going to be monetized or whatever. Literally, it's just, here it is, and here's how is it monetized. You know, no already presupposition of, you know, what this company is going to do and what, how's this game going to take advantage of you.
Yeah, I'm torn on this, because there are times where, like, the Wolverine announcement, it's like, okay, that's really exciting. But then there's a part of me that's like, why'd you do that? Why'd you tell me that? Because now it's in my brain and I don't want it there.
You can build something better, cheaper, faster. And then essentially, like, they might not hit this, you know, and then that's the risk. Sorry, go ahead, though.
No, yeah, I'm torn because it's, what purpose does it serve for me to know that? I think, sadly, there is still that shareholder aspect. They need the public and the shareholders to see these really good investments. It's good for the public and for the shareholders and potential investors to see, like, oh, wow, another Marvel title. But then there's a part of me that's like, don't do that. Don't tell me that. I don't want to know about something until it's around the corner. You see these trailers and, oh, the graphics are breathtaking. And then they don't even put a year on the screen. They just, that's it. They're just, hey, this is the game we're making. Or, you know, let's say it's 2022 and they throw up a 2024 date. I'm like, I can't even think that far ahead right now. You know, it's hard enough to think into the next month sometimes. So I've become more of the opinion that the shorter the window, the better, because you end up showing stuff so early, it's not even what the product's going to be. You're just showing me concepts. You're showing me some test build that you forced your devs to make look pretty. And then 4 years later, when the game lands, you got, you know, Watch Dogs is a great example of that's, we never got that game. We just never did. That game doesn't exist. That game they showed us way back then.
Anthem is another classic example. The devs learned what they were making when they announced the game. They're like, oh, that's what we're making? Good to know.
Yeah. I remember the first Anthem video we saw, they were running and it was storming and there was animals stampeding and there was lightning. I thought, what on earth? Like, what? How is this? This game looks incredible. And then you played it. You go play it and go back and look at that trailer. And it's like, what purpose in the grand scheme of things did that trailer serve? Like, what was the purpose? What was the point?
That trailer sold a lot of people on the game. Like, it sold a lot of people on the game. I remember literally saying, guys, don't pre-order this game. Like, while I enjoyed the javelins of Anthem specifically, like, I was like, they got this right. I really think if they invest and rework a lot of this stuff, could they turn it around? Yeah, we've seen that happen. So there is a case that that's a possibility. I hope they do. And then they said, we're going to do that. And then they said, no, never mind. We changed our mind. But like, essentially, like, a lot of people, like, I got so much hate for, like, guys, don't pre-order. Like, we haven't really seen this game. Don't pre-order. Oh, you're just a hater. I was like, no, I'm not. Like, I'm saying, like, it's your money. But, like, I would just caution, you know. And then it's like, okay. And then at the same time, I was like, I still played it for a long time. And people were like, oh, yeah, this game sucks. I was like, guys, like, maybe they'll turn around. I don't know. You know, I'm going to enjoy what I'm going to enjoy. And that's just the internet thing. And that's where it comes down to. Like, why, like, that trailer, Anthem was, like, one of the top grossing games of the year that it came out. Like, it made tons of money. And that trailer made them a ton of money. Mm-hmm. And if that's their goal, then they, you know, then they did. But, you know, I'm not going to trust any game as a service game that company releases from here on out. You know, and that's the cost. They got me once and they won't get me again.
Yeah. Yeah. And commonly, I do think that strategy worked, but it just isn't working like it used to. So I do think you're seeing a shift now. I think Starfield is one where I am actually applauding them not showing us stuff.
Yeah.
My gut instinct on the delay had more to do with the language they were using. It seemed very abstract. It seemed very big and broad, which made me think, I just don't think this game's coming out anytime soon. I'm worried it's going to be one of those games that gets out from underneath of them. But I applaud what they're doing. One of the reasons that I think that game still will be and still has a very high potential to be, I think, the flagship for Microsoft is because they're not showing us anything. So the delay stings, but it doesn't sting nearly as bad if we had seen some 20-minute presser about all the things you were going to get to do. I think the delay would hurt way more when that the salivation gets higher. It's like, oh, I saw gameplay. I saw a planet and I saw guns. And I actually applaud the fact that they have not been showing us stuff. Same with Redfall. We don't really have a whole lot of clue about what that game is about. So it's been easier for me mentally to kind of just shelve that over here. It's like, I don't even have a clue what those games are going to be like. So I'm totally accepting of the delay. I do think it hurts the Microsoft ecosystem, and I do think it hurts the Game Pass a little bit, because those were going to be pretty big centerpieces for 2022 and being on Game Pass. But I hope more companies start doing that, because it does two things. Number one, I think you end up in a healthier relationship with the community, and it also gives you that room to say, listen, we can delay. We haven't shown that much. If we have to make big changes, like right now, if they're gutting something and having to take it out, well, guess what? You didn't promise that to us.
Yeah,
you
didn't show it to Pokemon. Us. It's nobody's favorite Pokemon. Everybody has a favorite Pokemon. And when you launch a Pokemon game and yours happens not to be there, you'll be frustrated. Same kind of thing. Oh, I was really excited about that feature. So you're 100% right on that, because then all of a sudden, oh, that feature wasn't working. It was causing problems. You're immediately like, but that's what I wanted. That's what sold me. And now all of a sudden it's not there. So you're you got it, knocked it right out of the park, because turns out we reworked it. Now there is a clock on it though. I think essentially what you want to see is Starfield. I would say give them a year. But if it's outside of a year, then I would say the game's in a real mess. Mm-hmm. But if they can turn it around in a year, that's going to be great. And that actually kind of leads me into the kind of a thought that I had while you're while we're talking about the subject, is that I think that puts a lot of pressure on Halo. I think Halo coming in could be another flagship title. Yeah, came out last year. But guess what? Season 3 starts in November. And if they end up bringing and firing on all cylinders, like, hey, we added a ton of content, this, and this. It's basically like, well, we kind of had a year of a beta. We kind of worked out all the bugs. We kind of worked out our messaging. We kind of worked out our marketing. And now we also have a ton of content in a game that people have a connection with. That's going to be our flagship this fall. Again, Halo this year, Halo next year, and Halo the next year after that, because it's a games as a service, baby.
I want Halo to be so good this fall. I really do, because we tried to cover it and play it, and I could not believe how quickly the tires just let out of air. It was like I covered it the day that the season started. I was like, hey man, that was good turnout, good numbers, people really care. We tried covering it 2 days later. It was like I was talking about a dead game. I could have had more people for a Borderlands 1 video. It was like, there's nobody here. No one cares. We tried to do a community game night. It was a third of what I probably got to tune into and turn out for the first time when the game first came out. So I'm just, man, please, can you guys nail this? Because it really is a fun game. Like, I enjoy it. It's so irritating.
They have that. And then everything that's packaged around it. And you called it, like, I was remember watching your videos going into it, and even into the beta, like, y'all's progression system is garbage. There's no meaningful progression. And that's one of the things that I was always kind of curious about, is that how do I invest in my character? How do I invest in my Spartan? And right now it's so tied around these challenges and its seasonal model that it doesn't feel like I don't need to play. And you can play for just the fun, but I have other games that are also just as fun and also are way more rewarding, and it feels easier to get in and have that experience. And so I think Halo can turn it around. Like, it's got the budget, it's got the brand, you know, it's not like some kind of like indie, like, well, we're going to try this shooter thing and see if it works. No. Like, you've got that established brand. And what I think essentially, think about this, like, imagine if we had Forge right now. Like, even outside the broken progression system, imagine if the community was like, great, you came out with one map for Arena and one map for Big Team. We got you covered. We've remastered every map that's ever been in Halo that people love. Go nuts and have fun. Like, all of a sudden you're like, oh yeah, I love playing this version and that version, et cetera. And I think, honestly, my personal experience, I really like the last mode, the last Spartan Standing that they added. I really like that. Doesn't have to be for everybody. So I do feel like there's hope to be had, but every time that end of match progression thing pops up, I just want to delete you off my hard drive. Like, how did you miss this bad. Like that. Anyway, I don't want to rant. Turns out we ranted about Halo for an hour.
Well, we should include Halo in the show because I forgot about this. This could be great or awful. I don't know how to read this just yet. Halo Infinite head of design has left 343 Industries. Jerry Hook is gone 2 days ago.
Good deal.
So because that could be great.
That could be great.
Because he could have been philosophically at odds with where the game needs to go. He could have been one of the problems, because I've always said that it's not the devs, it's not the engineers, it's the people that have designed these maps, the guns, the feel of the game is right where it belongs. There is a leadership problem somewhere at this company. There is somewhere, there is a bottleneck somewhere that is ruining this game. The decision making doesn't make sense. It's been poorly managed. Poor Joseph Staten came in and barely got this thing out of the door.
So this could be a really good sign. You got Joseph back. You can, like, and the fact is, like, I know 343's got a bad rep right now, rightfully so. But yeah, I don't want to like fault the people who are doing the work. It's leadership. I always going to start there. That's the thing. Your leadership, right or wrong, it's your fault. You know, it's like, let's go with that. And so I think they can. I think that they can. I want them to so badly. But I cut you off. Sorry about that.
No, I was seeing this guy leave. I think at first when I saw that, I thought, oh, that could be bad. And then I kind of thought, well, no, I think if the runway to November and the year beyond, because really this year is just scrapped in my mind. It's just scrapped.
Yeah, 6 month seasons. It's just people are already winded and you're only a month in. And it's like, guess what? How long do you wait for a new map? 5 months. All right, I'll just wait 5 months and I'll go play another game. Like, I don't need to be mad at Halo to enjoy another game. Like, I can just be like, all right, you tell me when you're ready.
Yeah.
You call me, you know, house is ready. You ready to pick up? We ready to go to dinner? Awesome. Let's go. Oh, you're going to be five months from now. Perfect. I'll go out with somebody else. You call me when you're ready.
It's like, yeah. Easy breezy. And I agree with Paul. I think Bonnie Ross is the next person. They got to get out of there. I've read some quotes from her and some of her ideas and stuff, and it's like, I don't think she's a fit. I think there are people, like, I don't want to hang everything on Jerry Hook's, you know, neck. I don't think this is all on him, but I think certain people, it's time to go. You're not a fit here. I mean, I don't play the game anymore, but I remember when a bunch of people at Bungie left and everyone got freaked out, and I said, this is probably necessary. And I would hazard a guess that the strong reception to Witch Queen and then how the game is in a good spot and has been well praised. I check the community numbers every once in a while, and I'm like, they're steady, man. They're rock solid live service game to the point that Sony wants them to help them build live service infrastructure. Like, that's how successful Bungie has been. I think they did it. I think they pulled it off because they got some of those people out of there that were barriers and were not helping the game become under one unified vision. And if that's what needs to happen for Halo Infinite, then some of the big dogs might need to pack it up and go somewhere else.
Yeah, the nice thing, though, and I know we, again, on the 343, like, yeah, do whatever you need to do, right? Like, if Bonnie's the problem, Bonnie can go find another job. She'll be fine. Severance packages are wonderful in that company. But you also have id. You also have all of this great talent. You have the coalition. Like, the thing that I think, if you go play Gears 5, and it's such a beautiful experience, like, everything just kind of feels so good. Mm-hmm. And then you're like, what the hell? Like, just who's the guy designing that? Bring him over here and make it work over here. Cause it's like they went with kind of not a traditional battle pass model, but it's got these seasonal things. It's going on and it's a lot of fun. And it's not, I don't think, as big as Halo, but yeah, if you got the budget of Halo, like, you know, you own those companies, those people work for you, pick up the phone, you know, let's get this figured out. And I think it will be great if they figure it out. I think it could be really great. And the only downside is that you kind of have to go through this, you know, what it seems like almost the standard fare for games as a service. Like, it's like, oh yeah, this game is going to be a 10-year game. It's better to wait a year. Like, it's, if you wait a year, you're going to have a better experience than everybody coming in, you know, like me griping about it.
It's interesting too, because Sony, people are going to say I'm just being a Sony fanboy, but I wonder if their strategy is the one that other companies need to take. They sat on the sidelines, just, we're not going to do live service, And now they're going to be able to tap into, you know, Bungie's almost decade-long experience with a successful live service game and well-developed live service technology, infrastructure, all that. That might be the strategy. Like, if you want to build a live service game, you need to look at what everybody else has done, because a lot of them, maybe we would even say a majority of them, have failed. Why'd they fail? What were the reasons? What can you extrapolate from that for your own game design? And that's where Sony is going to have a massive advantage, that when they finally step into the live service realm, they have one of the kings in their corner helping them set it all up.
With the experience and the lessons learned, because I'd even say Destiny did fail. Like, I remember going through all of those growing pains with Destiny 1 and Destiny 2. In fact, one of my biggest videos for the longest time as a content creator was like, I'm done with Destiny. And it's because I got, like, I just got drained. I was like, why is it, like, what's wrong? Like, what went wrong? And then when they started like, oh, we're going to like go in this other direction, I was like, okay, then they got me back. And now you're right. They understand these things about what it means. That's why I think they got bought for $3.6 billion plus whatever else they're working on. And yes, to Sony's plan, games as a service, as much as gamers gripe about them, I think it's such a smart business strategy for Sony in the long run, so that you can still get and maintain these big blockbuster single player titles, while at the same time not having this desert of like, well, that single player title doesn't generate money every month. We need money coming in every month, and then we can have these big windfalls, you know?
Yeah. Their structure, their seasonal structure, I went and took a peek. I hadn't checked on the game in over a year, and I went and took a peek, and there was a certain level of comfort that came from how predictable it was. I was like, okay, this is exactly kind of what I expected. So that helped me not to develop this, you know, sort of longing or jealousy or anger. It was like, okay, this is pretty predictable. But then I realized, man, this just works. This is a machine that just works. It generates revenue. It gets logins. It gets people playing. And other games can start to mimic this. They can. They 100% can mimic what Destiny is doing, whether it's Assassin's Creed Infinity or any of the live service games that come out of Sony. I really think that model will start to become far more common, which, being predictable, is actually not a bad thing in this environment, because then people know what to expect. Every 3 months, I'm going to give you 10 or 15 bucks, and I'm going to get these couple of things that will keep me satisfied for anywhere from 2 to 6 weeks, depending on who the player is. And then I'll come back and do it all over again. And those rhythms are really important for revenue, for the devs, for the publishers. So I think we're on the precipice of, funny enough, I haven't really, I should have been tooting this horn and putting this feather in my cap. I was telling people that I think the next big theme for gaming is live service. And I haven't really taken the Sony news and been like, see, I told you this was going to be a thing. But I do. I think that's the next big theme in gaming. And everybody thinks live service is a dirty word. I'm like, if they do it right, it can be very, very good.
So, yeah, essentially that's what you're getting at, is that's kind of where it's going, to the season model. I see chat kind of debating the term of failure in this regard, as they're taking offense because they're thinking of Destiny now as opposed to like when it was launched. Fail does not mean done. A lot of people like, no, like, speaking of our fourth topic, New World, a lot of people say New World failed. People will make it the same argument that you're making against the language I'm using if New World continues to persist. And so Destiny continued to persist, and they learned those lessons from what year one of Destiny 1 brought, and we got the Taken King, which really like reinvigorated the community. Same thing with Destiny 2, where we got first, you know, Forsaken. And it's like, that essentially was like, okay, we learned these lessons. And that's why like failure isn't a bad thing. Like, you learn more from failure than you do from winning. Like, that is a life lesson in and of itself. And so hopefully that helps clear up, you know, any kind of confusion in that regards. So you go ahead, Lona.
No, yeah, I took what you were saying is that failure has a pretty big range of meaning. Like, you would have to fail in order to succeed. And I think it was like, year one of Destiny 1 and year one of Destiny 2, it was like watching someone try to launch a business and fail and not do a very great job. And then boom, like you had Taken King, boom, you know, you had Forsaken. Yeah, No Man's Sky, another great example.
Final Fantasy 14.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. You have to fail. They fall on their face and get back up, which
I'm a baseball player, so it's like legitimately in baseball, you fail more than you actually win. And the best players fail like 3 out of 10 times. You know, like the best player fails 3 out of every 10 times. That's usually the mindset and model that I always go with. It's the people who persist. It's about getting back up to the plate and then about taking another swing. Yeah, it's not about like, oh, they failed and they shut that down. That's not failing in gaming.
It's called learning, not failing. I mean, I that's being a little pedantic. I think that they learn through the failure. Like, I do. I think plenty of games have gone through this. That first year is just, it's not what they wanted to deliver. It's not what the consumers expected. And I think it's totally okay to call that a failure. It's okay to call No Man's Sky a failure when it first came out. It's like, it failed to deliver what so many people were wanting. And I think that's a greater testimony to just how far some of these games have come, that they actually were able to push through what other companies didn't. Like, Anthem failed and just could not get back on the horse. It just never went. It just never got back up and kept on going.
Well, it's because they quit. Like, that's how I can also define the terms themselves, is that, like, if you go and look at New World right now, you would say it's a failure. If you go back to D1 year one, like, so many people were telling me it was a failure. I maintained and continued to play it because I enjoyed it. I was like, oh, there's something really cool here. I can't wait to see where they go with it. But that's because I play those kind of games. I've lived through all these live service game year ones to know that, well, if they keep making content, there's going to be a year two and there's going to be a year three. You know, in that regards. And I think that's what you want. You want somebody to sit here and have that open dialogue and communication. Like, the general gaming community, like, you go online, you can find any game. Every game's a dead game, according to YouTube.
Yeah. I think you have to be able to use that word in different circumstances, because if we only ever say failure when the game has completely shut down, we're almost never going to say that. Like, you know, Cyberpunk in my mind failed, and they still haven't necessarily climbed out of that category for me. I still feel that game is not what it needs to be. It's not up to what they promised. It's not up to those trailers. Just because the game is continuing to ongo and add and have players doesn't mean that word can't be applicable. I do. I think it's important, especially in the gaming industry, to leave room for that. Like, man, you guys really failed, but that's okay. You know, New World, which we're literally about to transition into, this is why I want to hear about this, because New World, in my mind, like, it kind of failed. It was like, man, this was not what I was looking for. It doesn't feel well-rounded. It didn't feel like you guys really thought through some of this stuff, and it just continued to see that player exodus. So that's just such a great transition into what's going on with that game right now.
Well, I mean, right now they're continuing to update the game. In fact, they just yesterday got their biggest update, what they've actually kind of transitioned into a seasonal model, which essentially I think that is the games as a service model going forward, this concept of seasons. Like, hey, we're going to have this big content thing. So they just wrapped up their big update for their spring season, which introduced like a 3v3 arena mode. They've added new stories that are taking a part of these the knights that are like intruding in, these Vikings that are somewhat trying to take over the island itself. And overall, like, the game's like incredibly stable. Like, they added the blunderbuss back in March. We know a great sword's coming this fall with a whole new zone and a whole new area. And the summer's going to be, looks like it's going to be pretty exciting with a lot more quality of life adjustments and new dungeons and things like that. So all in all, like, that brings back that, you know, that concept. Like, yeah, and that's why I always say, like, the concept is like, did the game fail you? Everybody's going to have an individual kind of approach to it. And yeah, like, would it have been great if, like, New World launched and maintained, you know, 100,000, 200,000 concurrent active players? I'm sure, like, the devs would absolutely love those numbers right now, especially when you compare it to Lost Ark, which is absolutely just destroying it in terms of numbers and player retention, as well as bot retention. That's another big category that free-to-play MMO can win in terms of botting, because there's no risk. Emails are free. So at its core, the game is continuing to develop. The devs are communicating, and that's what I look to see in terms of any live service game. Are the devs communicating? Are they talking with the community? Are they hearing the feedback? Are they then asking follow-up questions to the feedback that they get? Because somebody could easily say, like, oh, it'd be nice if they had X. And when I see the devs come back and say, oh, when you say X, like, do you mean like it in this way, or do you mean like it in that way? I think that shows that a game has promise. And the old, like, the question, though, when it comes down to that, and why, like, again, to that conversation we just had in transition to this one, like, if you take this slice of time, and if you apply that feeling and emotion, if we fast forward in 3 years and they've released a couple of expansions and the game's continuing to grow year over year over year, like, would you say that this year one was a failure? And it's like, yeah, like, absolutely. Like, but it was always going to be that, like, especially when I look at any games as a service. What I'm really curious about, kind of as a kind of a touch on, you know, bringing two topics together, is that what does Bungie do when Sony launches its next game as a service? And does it hit the market without the problems that we've seen games as a service games have? Or is that just, you know, because every time a games as a service game comes out, everybody's always like, needs more content, doesn't do everything all these other games do. And then eventually the game gets to a point where it does that, you know, and everybody keeps saying they should launch it with 3 years of content. Like, is that the model? Like, is whatever Sony launches, does it launch with 3 years of content ready to go in the holster? That if they do that, they will redefine the model. Nobody will be able to do anything less than that, otherwise they're just, you're not going to get any kind of buy-in.
Yeah, that's the real ticket. That has always been the ticket. I've always said it became sort of painfully repeated in my stream. It's like, I know that game companies can create great trailers and really great gameplay. I know that you can. I've played plenty of games. Anthem had great gameplay. I've not played a game yet that felt that good to fly around. I still to this day have this longing for an Iron Man game because of that game. It did something to me. Yeah. And that gameplay was so memorable, my nephews would ask, have you played the Iron Man game again? Like, it was so visually memorable to people. So I know you can create good gameplay. The question has never been, can you create a good gameplay loop? Can you create a good content loop? It's, how are you going to build this game to have elasticity and longevity? Because if you can't do that, then you've wasted everyone's time. And if you want to build a single player game, fine. Build a one-off, build something that's not intended to be ongoing. But the minute you step your foot into that pool, it's like the difference between swimming in somebody's backyard pool and getting in an Olympic sized pool. Can you go the distance? Because if not, you're going to drown. You're going to try to swim all the way to the other side, and you're not going to make it because you haven't prepared yourself for the length of the pool. And that's the real test of a live service game, is you can't just talk about the first month or the second or third month. The thing that's going to give me confidence in a live service game that comes out and starts talking to me about their brand new IP, when you start talking to me about year two, then I know you mean business. You know what you're doing, because you're not just trying to get me to buy and hook me for the first couple of months and bleed me for cash, and then that's the end of it. You start talking about the next year or the next season, then I know that you know what you're doing.
Yeah, so just the fact that New World has announced, like, they announced their spring, summer, and fall seasons for the content kind of roadmap, essentially. I'm also, especially after Anthem, always hesitant when it comes down to roadmaps. I'm like, I just don't believe it, because, like, I've seen roadmaps, and then essentially then, oh, well, we just scrapped that, right? Like, it was just a drawing on a piece of paper. We're trying to figure out what we're going to do. And so when it comes down to it, it's that I think what I'm looking in terms of what I... for the future for New World specifically is them announcing an expansion, because it does two things. It does exactly, it communicates a level of investment that words just don't mean. Like, you don't trust Amazon Game Studios yet because they haven't earned that trust. They haven't been around long enough to say, oh, well, yeah, I know whatever. Like, let's say, you know, Destiny launches an expansion and there's something they get wrong. And we've seen that happen, like with one season over the next, et cetera. But then it gets corrected, and I know that it's going to get corrected. So there's no point in me, like, there's no, like, oh, okay, somebody's like, oh man, they really messed that up, I'm so mad. Oh, well, you know, just make sure you put that on the forums. That's what the general community is thinking. Oh, it turns out that it was fixed within a couple of weeks. things happen, you know, whether that was intentional or that was just a bug, like things can happen, right? But they've earned that. And so like Amazon is in that process of kind of earning that. And so I always kind of wonder, like, will we see a live service game, like an MMO or like any kind of looter shooter, like in that category, launch without the same problems that every live service game has? And the real testament to the live service is those who continue to persist. So I think New World's been making really good updates. That's really important, but it's not going to move tons of numbers. Like, you're still seeing anywhere from 20 to 30,000 concurrent players on the servers, which translates into roughly like 400 plus thousand monthly active users based off of the hours played. Like, overall, like a general healthy population for any kind of online game, but not obviously what, you know, when you go look at Lost Ark or Elden Ring, even still today, Elden Ring is just continuing to dominate and as a non-live service game. And that's the counter argument that everybody makes. They're like, oh, look, Elden Ring does that. Great. A game every 12 years comes out and really just like takes the world by storm. Gotcha. That's not the model that people are, Sony's looking for more consistent in revenue, consistent in those live service games. And maybe they have them bundle those up together. But I think right now New World's in, it's probably the best shape it's been, but it still needs a lot of work for the, what, when I listen to people who said like they, the reason why they left New World, it's like, some of it's been fixed, some of the stuff is on the way, but I still think and maintain that an expansion is going to be that game's biggest thing. And I would say that honestly, if they do the expansion model, then I think you announce your next expansion alongside that. Hey, our new expansion's out. And guess what? In a year or a year and a half or whatever, we're already starting to work on our next expansion. Like, oh, cool, there's longevity here. My time that I invest in my character isn't going to have that rug pull happen, and that's what keeps people from even playing. Everybody that I talk to who's new and is returning, they're absolutely loving the game. They're like, oh, this is great, they fixed this, they've done that, this is, I'm having fun.
Well, the problem with New World in my mind then is that the best case scenario is a worst case scenario, because if they do this expansion and we all come storming back, aren't we going to create a whole lot of problems? Because how many servers have migrated? I mean, I don't know. I'm kind of curious how that's going to work. If we all come surging back, what's that going to look like for the servers and stability? And like right now, I have no idea what the status of my server is. I don't have a clue.
Yeah.
So what happens if I come back? I mean, have they merged people into my server to the point that if all of a sudden everybody that's like me comes storming back, are we going to throw that server into queue hell? Like, I'm just curious what that's going to look like for them.
You would. At this moment, you would. And that's where, like, I've always kind of said they needed this day one. Like, some of the things they needed to be there before they launched. And one of the things is the ability to guest on a server. No one wants to sit and wait in queue. And it would have been nice if they were like, oh, well, while you wait in queue for your world, for your spot on your server, why don't you just go be a ghost player over on somewhere like where you're just playing, running around, but you're not necessarily like impacting the wars, right? You're like, I'm just here, just having fun. I'm just leveling, running quests. Okay, my server's ready. You know, it's been nice, you know, just kind of hanging out on this low pop server. And some people in chat says New World has servers with like 50 people. Specifically, there are players who legitimately have main small servers because that's where they want to play, and players are free to transfer and move around however they want right now. So there are legitimately, I know people who are like, all right guys, we're going to go to the smallest server and we're going to just stick on that server, and we're happy with it. So that's actually a part of the community debate. Like, what if you want to play on a small pop server? How do you maintain that? Because what we've seen is with the mergers, there are people like, please don't merge our server. We like that there's, you know, typically 50 to 100 people on the server. And so it's like, I say that's where they've already addressed it in terms of the roadmap, but it's still going to be a thing to wait, because the punishment you have on playing on the small server is with some of the content, like Outpost Rush, which is a level 60 PvP, is that it does require, you know, 40 people who want to do that. And that means that your whole server basically has to want to do that, because there's no cross-server matchmaking for that. And they did talk about bringing in cross-server matchmaking, because then essentially playing on a low-pop server versus a high-pop server, there's not really a disadvantage. In fact, you could actually take heavily advantage of being on a low-pop.
Yeah. I want that game to be what everybody wanted it to be. I really enjoyed playing it. It was fun. They had... some of the right pieces and recipes to get people to just be in the world. I still think it's some of the greatest sound design that I've got to experience. The trees falling and the hitting rocks and chop. There's something special there. And that's how you get people to stay in your game. That's how you get people to always come back, is when that content loop just feels good. The issue that they're just going to continue to have to deal with is, I feel that they set up so many things logistically that appeal to players that you sort of, it doesn't surprise me that people want to be on low pop servers, because that's exactly what I kept saying was going to be the problem, is there's going to be a lot of people that are drawn to this game that just want to chop trees down and go run quests. Like, they don't want to worry about map control. They don't want to worry about wars and PvP. And what do you do with those people? It's the age old Sea of Thieves debate, right? If you just want to play Sea of Thieves and sail and quest and make your pirate ship look cooler, it's really tough to do that with the way that that game typically goes, with PvP and people kind of messing with you. And that's been one of the long-standing debates about Sea of Thieves, is that, well, that's the spirit of the game, is that it's a pirate game. And with New World, I remember people saying that. They're like, that's just, it's the spirit of the game, is these wars and these PvP elements. And I kept saying, I don't think this is the right move. You have to give people the option to not have to worry about that. And that's my long-standing concern for New World, is no matter how much content you deliver, no matter how expansions come out and how great the game gets with respect to quality, you're always going to have these elements that make it very difficult for the servers and the community to maintain engagement, because you just feel like, if I don't go hardcore and war it up and PvP it up and map control it up, then I just don't want to play. You get a distaste, or you do what some people, as you said, are doing. They're just going to sort of flock to those low pops.
Yeah. And I literally had people transfer off my server when we got merged, because they're like, oh, there's a server that's, let's go over here and just play and just kind of play in our casual way. And that's essentially the challenge of the MMO. Like, they introduced the updates that have, like, even with today's or this week's PvP update, which they added 3v3 arena, which basically you can start doing at level 20, which I think is the right call. But it's like 3v3 PvP, ready to go. That's going to appeal to people who like PvP, and that's great. But if you're not interested in PvP whatsoever, like, that wasn't the update for you. And they added this big old reward track for PvP. So as you do anything in PvP, you're leveling up this entire, like, reward track and getting all this stuff and this loot. And it's actually a lot of fun as somebody who likes PvP. But being honest about the game, is like, if you're just here for the PvE, like, this update did have some PvP PvE updates for you, but not massive. And that's just going to take time and work. And, I'm rooting for them. I think for the genre as an the MMO genre as a whole benefits if New World does well, because the last MMO that was introduced was WildStar. And before that, everything's well over 10 years old. So everybody's either mad at MMOs, but then at the same time, a new one comes out and, if you're not going to support it, then you're just going to have to be fine with MMOs that are 10, 12, 20 years old. And maybe that's it. Maybe the genre doesn't need another game. Maybe that's all the genre is. WoW, 14, 11, Elder Scrolls, EverQuest, and that's it. And, that's the only other conclusion I can come up with.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, maybe that's the ticket. Maybe the ticket is to develop this sort of split and maybe this would really purify the servers. Cause if you're like hardcore and you're wanting to do the PvP and the wars and the faction and the map control, and if you're wanting to do that, why don't you go into a server that's like that? Why don't you have servers marked that way?
I've also thought of the same kind of thing when I see a lot of people who want that hardcore PvE experience. That, they're like, oh man, like, I don't want to be able to solo any enemy open in the open world. I want that party requirement. Like, instead of like designing the whole game around it, just design a server. Just have like rules that the server says, okay, sure, on this server that you can't transfer on or off, this is your hardcore character server, and you know, whether it's PvE or like, but you're right, to the same point of PvP, and see if there's interest. Because I, from a data scientist study perspective, I'd love to see if those servers were the big draw, because they might be. You know, Elden Ring shows that there's a draw for hard, challenging content, for having content, you know, punch you in the face, you know, and that in and of itself shows that I think there's a demand for it. And if we baby everybody so that, like, this game, anybody can play it, like, well, you're kind of making trade-offs. There's sacrifices that you're making. Same kind of concept where, should you add matchmaking to raids in Destiny? Like, the debate ends up being is like, well, if you do, there's going to be a cost in design, because if you get matched with somebody who has no ability to clear the content, you're going to just get mad anyway. You know, like, are you mad that you can't find somebody to clear the content? Or are you going to be even more mad when you get matched with somebody who can't even hit the broadside of a barn? Because you will get matched with that person. That person exists. They will queue up, you know? So it's like, there are always going to be those trade-offs. And I would personally just adore it if we saw that actually happen. Here's the hardcore server world. PvP, you don't have a choice to not be flagged. It literally is, here's that. And then if all of a sudden it's so popular, people can't get on that server, okay, we're going to make another one of that. And, you know, kind of almost like testing out that you think you do, but you don't kind of mindset. I'm game for it, 100%.
Yeah, I would be very interested in what a just purely PvE, you know, no faction, no map control, none of that. Just what that kind of a server would look like, because that's where I would go. That's what I want to do. I just want to quest it up. I don't have to worry about, I'm not in my territory, you know, and these guys have this advantage. It's like demoralizing when you boot up and look at the map and you're like, well, we got nothing, you know, like, you know, it kind of feels bad. And I know that that's part and parcel to the experience, but it's one of those things where you don't know what people want. It's almost like you don't know what you don't know until you know what you don't know. It's like, you have no idea until people get in there and start fiddling around with it, that they decide that, I don't really like this faction thing. I thought it was going to be dope, and I'm kind of annoyed by it.
Yeah, I'd rather it be something where it is more even company-driven as opposed to faction. But then there's, like, you got to have systems in place to help kind of counterbalance those things, because then otherwise everybody just flocks to one company that literally just owns everything. We were right now seeing legitimately, as a part of the PvP reward track, an exploit that people are taking advantage of is, you know how you can go capture the forts, you know, and so there's value. So they've added perks to forts. Like, if you control this fort, you get free teleports. If you control this fort, you get more experience. If you control, like, they've added all these like cool little perks, etc., to owning forts. But what people have done, and this is the coolest and at the same time the silliest thing in my mind, you see every faction hanging out in the fort, just taking over the fort and not fighting each other, because just the part of switching ownership is what gets you that progress, and it's just easy and more efficient. So everybody was just like, well, we all like each other anyway. We all are actually doing the PvE content together anyway. What if we all just go hang out in this zone and take over the fort, and then you take over the fort, and then I take over the fort, and we just trade off and not fight, and we're going to all progress at a ridiculous pace. And that's actually what's happening, and it's freaking hilarious. Because I go in, I'm like, what's happening? And you just see everybody standing around just going like, just having fun, and nobody's fighting. It's like, okay, well, I guess I'll stand in the circle.
Yeah, Zubair says, isn't that just a co-op survival game? Well, that's the thing. If servers developed a theme, does it really matter if people are playing and enjoying themselves, right? Like, is it a hardcore PvP server? It's like, well, isn't that just a PvP game? You know what I mean? It's like, yeah, that's the point is, you know, if that's the theme that emerges and you suddenly realize you have this massive swell of players, that look what No Build did for Fortnite. Look how many people came surging back to play Fortnite, mm-hmm. because you took one of the fundamental pieces of Fortnite out, and it really brought a ton of people back. And I think sometimes you have to do the thing that seems contrary to the spirit of the game and just see what players are playing, because I'm never one to say, pull that out of the game. Make the mm-hmm. game for me. But sometimes I'm like, is it really worth it if people aren't playing your game? You know, look at Sea of Thieves, you know, 17,000 concurrent on Steam. Like, I don't feel like they've captured this massive concurrent player base, but I continue to believe that if Sea of Thieves gave me a PvE option, I'd be playing it regularly with my wife in my living room, and I'm not, and I can't be alone in that. You know, these games, sometimes you've got to give player volition and choice and just see what happens. And Fortnite did it, and you got to wonder, man, that might have paid off in spades for them. How much money did they make from people who weren't playing Fortnite for years or months at a time, who came surging back and are playing no build, and they're spending money maybe?
Well, and there's that establishment of like, oh, I've already played that. That's actually one of the things that I think is will work out in New World's benefit if they keep making content, is that, oh, you've already bought in the game. Like, there's no sub. It's just free to go and play the game. You know, just like, oh, just update and you can check out, you know, the all the changes, etc. But I think essentially kind of that kind of key aspect of like, what are they going to add that's going to bring a lot of people back and really kind of get that excitement going? And the no build with Fortnite is a good example, but it's also, that's a heavily marketed, heavily publicized example. And it's able to get kind of like, yeah, obviously, like with Fortnite, you get Ninja and you get the big guys like all checking out kind of the no build, and that kind of reinvigorates it, especially if you've been maybe playing and living in Apex Legends or living in Warzone. It's like, oh, cool. Like, when I played, like, the reason I prefer Apex and Warzone over, Fortnite was, like, I don't like the building mechanics. I know that's a key aspect of the game itself, and I just, like, I don't like that. I'm like, no, I'm good. Like, and so I was like, nah. And so that they added that. I haven't checked it out yet, but I've definitely considered it, you know. But I'm honestly kind of still on the fence and hoping that we see a Halo Battle Royale. That's, you know, Last Man Standing is nice, but, I want to see what a full-on Halo Battle Royale would look like.
The no build is worth playing just for the fact that they completely changed traversal. You have this new way of sprinting and jumping and sliding. You have a built-in shield, so if you get shot out in the open, it doesn't immediately hurt your shields or your health. It's like 25 hit points, I think, and it recharges after so much time of not being in combat. So it's always there. It's just always there, and I think that is directly from, I know Ninja, myself, and there was somebody else who trotted out this idea of, what if you just had shields be on a recharge? So you didn't have to constantly scrounge for shields and carry shields. So I know they got that idea directly from the community. I wasn't the only one that said that, man, the rhythm of Fortnite, it'd be so great if I didn't have to constantly carry all this stuff, because, you know, my health is there. I got to maintain my health with bandages or med kits, and then the storm is hurting my health. But the need to constantly pick up shields and use them, as long as I'm not in combat, man, give me my shields back. They kind of did that. It's 25, and as long as you're on combat, it goes back, which is great, because if you can't build, you need a little bit of a buffer. Like, you start getting shot, you know, you get into cover, it didn't hurt your actual shields or your health. It just hurt your sort of tactical, I don't even know what they call it. Somebody in chat might have to tell me. But I loved that. I thought it was great. We had a blast. And truth be told, the real sweaty Fortnite players, they don't hang out in there. We played all night, and I don't think we ran into any high-skilled players, not at all. It was just mostly either bots or fairly lower-skilled players, which I'm totally fine with that. I haven't played in a year and a half. I need that. I'm just trying to have some fun and throw back some drinks with some buds. I'm not trying to sweat and put a headband on.
And a Willie says, and I forget, or Wilty, it looks like Willie, says that they were one of the ones who came back with the no builds with their daughter, and they spent hundreds of dollars on skins. And so far, both of them are level 208. So that definitely seems like, you know, a good call, obviously, from the Fortnite perspective. And that's the appeal of that, of the games as a service. Like, one of the things that games as a service ends up being is that it's a way of continuing reintroducing people coming back to the game. And at the same time, at some point, that customer is going to stop playing, and the games as a service game says, okay, well, as long as we keep doing whatever, maybe that customer comes back in the future. Maybe it's a change. Maybe it's a piece of content. Maybe it's a big event. You know, who knows? But it's that, what ends up happening is that you kind of see we see gamers, you know, kind of like be all in, take a break, you know, and come back. And I think the ones that kind of stick through and never stop are the ones that's where you kind of see them explode and be like, I've played this game for 10,000 hours and it's garbage. It's like, well, let's sit down and talk, because I don't think it's garbage. I think you got something out of the 10, but I think maybe you've kind of overextended yourself and you might want to go just check out another game for like a minute or two.
Definitely. Well, guys, those are the topics. We about an hour and a half. I'm happy with on this show. We don't stretch this show too long if we don't need to. And you know, without Mike, I felt like that was a great flyover of all the things we want to talk about. I don't want to delve into the bonus topic. We may save that for another day and save that.
Yeah,
that's
a good
topic. Have Mike here. Yeah. And we do like to send you to another video. So when this video ends, we will be sending you over to Reforged First Look. I'll put a link in chat as well. Got a nice first look at a game we got a code for. So try to support that video. We like to get those treatments, those codes from those developers. So help that video out. Stick around and ride the redirect. Also make sure tonight, in about 3 hours from now, Reforged Gaming will be doing Madam Game Night. I'll be playing with my wife games that tier 2 members are making us play, so it should be hysterical. Ginger, what should they be looking for you on? You working on any videos?
Yeah, so I'm working on my Astrologian controller guide for Final Fantasy 14. I was hoping to have that out this week, but this week just kind of got away from me. And that's kind of the big guide that I'm working on. I'm working on a getting started in Destiny guide, but that's probably going to be a little bit. And so at its core, like, I just like sitting down and making some guides, and that's currently what's on my radar. I'm working on two bigger videos. One, I just released my reaction content, breakdown, like, what does it actually look like? What are the pros and cons? And what am I going to do in terms of it going forward? So if you guys haven't seen those videos, I'd love it if you check them out. The TLDR is that any content that I react to, because I keep getting videos sent to me, Brian, you got to react to this. Brian, you got to do this. And I've always kind of like, I don't know how I feel about that. So I decided that, okay, like, when I look at the numbers, there's a massive demand for reaction content. It's like, I got, like, the internet's like, you know, hey, do you sell pizza? And you keep saying no. And they're like, all right, we'll go to everybody else selling pizza, because that's where we're going to get the thing we want. So, but I decided I'm going to do a 50-50 revenue share on any video that if I do a full reaction, as opposed to kind of more of a broken down response to any particular points, I'm going to share the revenue that my video makes with the original creator. And that's just essentially the conclusion I came to. So that's that. That play. Guides and continuing to make videos on YouTube, man. So
great.
That's what I do.
Great. Well, we appreciate you guys tuning into the Reforged Roundtable, weekly episodes here of the Reforged Roundtable, and then daily episodes here on Reforged Radio. Again, don't forget tonight, Reforged Gaming. It's about 3 hours from now. Again, if we ever, I don't know if Ginger does this, but if we do members only content on a channel, you have to go to the channel or go to the channel's community tab. It will not put the show in front of you. It just doesn't do
right.
It.
Yeah,
it
same thing.
It won't be in your feed. So make sure you're checking the channels for that. And again, if you stick around, I appreciate the support. It's going to redirect you to that first look of The Walking Zombie 2. It's actually a fun little game on PlayStation. So be sure to check that out and give it some love. And I hope to see a bunch of you tonight. And we will see you in the next episode of Reforged Radio. Thanks for watching. All right, guys. We'll see you next time.
Take care.